This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents House Rivals, a Joe DeMarco thriller by Mike Lawson. This book is read by Joe Barrett. To my agent, David Gernard. This is the 10th DeMarco novel, and were it not for David, the first one would never have been published. Words cannot express how much I appreciate all he's done for me. Prologue. She was young and strong, but she didn't stand a chance against them. There were three of them, all wearing black ski masks. One was skinny, shorter than her, and if it had been just him, she was sure she could have taken him. She would have beaten the shit out of him. But the other two were bigger than her. They were fat, but strong. It was after midnight, and she'd been forced to park to the side of the restaurant, and they took her just as she was about to get into her car. They rushed her as a group, and before she could scream, one of them clamped a hand over her mouth. Then they manhandled her to the back of the restaurant, out by the dumpsters, where she couldn't be seen by passing cars. They groped her a bit. The big guy who had his hand over her mouth was squeezing her right breast with his other hand, and the other big one cupped her crotch. He laughed and said, "Oh yeah, this is gonna be good." The little one didn't touch her. He just watched. The next thing she knew, she was on the ground, and one of them was sitting on her chest with his hand still clamped over her mouth, and the other big guy had a hold of her wrists so she couldn't use her fists. She thought they'd try to pull her jeans off next, and she tried to get her hands free to fight and started kicking at the short one who was still standing, but he was able to evade her thrashing legs. The short guy watched her struggle for a while, then knelt down and put his face close to hers. "You're going to stop," he said. "You're going to knock off all the bullshit and quit telling lies." His voice sounded familiar, but she didn't know who he was. "You're going to quit before people lose their jobs. You saw how easy it was tonight. If you don't stop, the next time we're going to take you someplace and take turns raping you. Then we'll tie you naked to a tree and leave you for the wolves. You understand?" She couldn't speak because the one man still had his hand over her mouth, and she couldn't even nod because he was pushing her head into the gravel. But she stopped struggling. When he'd said, "Next time," she knew she was going to be okay. "Let's go," the short guy said to his pals, and the one got off her chest, giving her left nipple a hard tweak before he did. Then they all took off running. It took her a while to get to her feet, and when she did, she almost collapsed back onto the ground. Her legs felt like they were made of rubber. She started crying as she walked back to her car, and it pissed her off that she'd been so scared they made her cry. She opened the door and picked up her cell phone, which she'd left in the cup holder, and dialed 911. As she was waiting for the cops to arrive, she thought, "Fuck you, I'm never going to stop." Chapter 1. Marjorie Dawkins was the mother of two boys. Bobby was 10, Tommy was 12. She was a busty 5'4", had a photogenic smile, and her hair was a lustrous chestnut brown. She used to wear her hair shoulder length, but got tired of fussing with it. Now she had Carla, over at Celine's, for $60 every 3 weeks, keep it short and simple, so all she had to do was blow dry it after she showered. Marjorie didn't have time to spend more than 5 minutes in the morning on her hair. Whenever anyone described her, they didn't say she was pretty. They always said she was cute. Her husband, Dick, was a good-looking, easygoing guy who could spend hours perfectly content doing nothing but punching a TV remote. When asked what he did for a living, he would say he was a day trader. The truth was that Dick was a stay-at-home dad, a nanny for their boys. As for the day trading, she'd give him $500 a month to play with and figured that so far this year he'd made a profit of maybe $19. Since Marjorie earned $250,000 a year, she figured any money Dick lost playing the market was a cheap price to pay to salvage his pride. Plus, it gave him something to talk about at parties. He was also, she had to admit, a good father. Bobby and Tommy adored him. And after 14 years of marriage, he could still jumpstart her libido. Like with her hair, Marjorie didn't have a lot of time for sex, so she was glad she had someone handy with a proper appendage when she was in the mood. Bill Logan was 6'1" and weighed exactly the same as he had in college, 180 pounds. He had thick dark hair, an attractive widow's beak, and when he smiled, a dimple appeared in his right cheek. Women loved that dimple. Bill's first name was actually Leslie. He was Leslie William Logan, and he'd never forgiven his mother. After he started to catch shit for the name, which began when he was about 6, he asked her why in the hell she'd named him that. She told him that Leslie had been her father's middle name, and that there were a lot of famous people named Leslie. There was Leslie Howard, the British actor in Gone with the Wind, and Leslie Nielsen, the guy in all those funny movies like The Naked Gun. You know, his mom said, the movie O.J. Simpson was in. And then there was the most famous Leslie of all, Bob Hope. His real name had been Leslie Towns Hope, which was why, Bill Logan said to his mom, Hope changed his name to Bob. Like his partner Marjorie Dawkins, Bill made a cool 250 grand a year. Unlike Marjorie, he didn't have a useless spouse and 2 kids to gobble up what he earned. He'd been married for a year when he was in his 20s, cheated on his bride 3 months after they said their vows, and was divorced 14 months after the wedding. There'd been nothing wrong with his wife. She had been and still was a sweet, attractive woman. The problem, Bill knew, was his nature. He just couldn't stay faithful. He could have been married to the actress Scarlett Johansson, who some magazine had just named the sexiest woman on the planet, and he would have cheated on her. He'd always figured that it was a good thing that he'd learned this about himself when he was young and before he had kids. He never again subjected any poor woman to the agony of marrying him. Bill Logan figured, all false modesty aside, that he'd probably slept with more women in North Dakota than any man his age. In Bismarck, he could hardly go into a bar or a restaurant and not run into some woman he'd bedded. The one woman he hadn't slept with, and never would, was Marjorie Dawkins. They just had too good a thing going, business-wise, to screw it up with sex. Bill parked his fire engine red Porsche Boxster next to Marjorie's black Jeep Cherokee. He drove the Porsche from May until September, but after that switched to a practical 4-wheel drive Chevy Tahoe with studded snow tires. Winters in North Dakota were a bitch. Their office was in a strip mall with 4 other businesses, a Hairmaster's staffed by a bunch of Vietnamese girls, a Subway operated by a cheerful, overweight Hispanic lady, and a FedEx Kinko's place that was really convenient for him and Margie. The 4th business had a sign next to the door so small you could barely read it that said, Laptop Repairs. More than half the time, the door had a closed sign in the window. The guy who owned the laptop repair shop was a long-haired doofus named Gordy Hewlett, and Bill and Marjorie hired him whenever they had any computer-related work they needed done, including a few jobs that some nitpickers might consider illegal. Gordy bathed infrequently, liked to wear jeans with holes in the knees, smoked a lot of pot, and quite often when Bill went into his shop, Gordy would be playing video games. And all those things were okay with Bill and Marjorie, because when they needed Gordy, he performed okay. When Bill walked into the office he and Marjorie shared, Marjorie waved a hand at him but kept talking to whomever she was talking to on the phone. She'd been there since 6:30. This was the way it had always been in the 10 years they'd worked together. Marjorie arrived at 6 or 6:30 and stayed until 3:30 or 4 because she was always attending her boys' after-school functions, soccer, basketball, baseball, whichever sport was in season. She wouldn't let her sons play football. Bill usually arrived at 9 or 10 and stayed as long as necessary. If there was something that needed to be done at night, like meeting a guy on a backwoods road, Bill handled that sort of thing. Business-related social events were different, and they both attended a lot of those, fundraisers, parties, rubber chicken dinners. Sometimes they'd both go to the events, and sometimes only one of them would go. Marjorie was just as good as Bill when it came to schmoozing folks. So they worked whenever they needed to, splitting the time and the various jobs in a way that suited them both. No one paid any attention to how many hours they worked or if they were in the office or not. The only thing that mattered to old man Curtis was that they got results. Their office was as bare bones as you could get. They had serviceable desks they'd bought at a place called Office Furniture for Less, and both had comfortable, ergonomic, tilt-back leather chairs. There were also a couple of rarely used visitor chairs and four tall metal file cabinets. They were really careful about what they put in the file cabinets. If they were ever served a subpoena, or if someone executed a search warrant, there couldn't be anything in those cabinets that could bite them on the ass. This meant that the only things in the file cabinets were phone directories and documents that were a matter of public record, like bills going through state legislatures, property records, and environmental studies. The stuff that could land them in jail was encrypted and stored in the cloud. And Gordy, the pot-smoking laptop repairman, had the files rigged so that they could be wiped out in 3 seconds from their smartphones, if it ever came to that. One reason the office was so poorly furnished was that they really didn't need anything better. If they wanted to impress someone, they rented a suite in a hotel. The other reason was that Curtis didn't mind paying their salaries, but he'd go crazy if he thought they were wasting his money on things they didn't need. Curtis may have been worth over $1 billion, but as the old saying goes, he'd squeeze a nickel till the buffalo shits. Marjorie hung up on whomever she'd been gabbing with and said to Bill, "I went to a parent-teacher conference last night, and one of the other moms said she saw you and Bobby's math teacher at the American Grill. I mean, for Christ's sake, Bill, do you think you're invisible? And in case you didn't know it, my kid's math teacher used to be married to a cop, and the cop still has a thing for her. Ah, she just happened to see me there at the bar and sat down for a minute to chat." Marjorie knew he was lying through his teeth. "So what's going on?" he asked to change the subject. "You know Buchanan, state senator, 9th district?" "Yeah." "I just found out his septic system failed, and it's going to cost about $28,000 to make things right. So I had Gordy do a little research on him. It looks like Buchanan's barely able to make his mortgage. And the main reason why is his daughter's going to Reed College over in Oregon, which is costing him a boatload." "Sounds like what Senator Buchanan needs," Bill said, "is a good contractor who can give him a deal on fixing that septic system." "That would help," Marjorie said. "Also, a guy who can get him a permit to build the new system on the same spot where the old one is. Buchanan's septic system sits near a creek, which was okay at the time it was built, but today that won't fly. It's going to cost him double to relocate the drain field." "Well, I know a guy who can take care of that." "I know you do. So you want to go talk to Buchanan?" "Ah, jeez. He lives in Belcourt, doesn't he? I mean, that's 200 miles from here." "Hey, you're the guy with the Porsche. What's the point of having one if you don't drive it once in a while?" "Yeah, okay. I'll do it. One other thing. Curtis is flying in on Tuesday. He's particularly anxious to hear how we're doing with Judge Morris. He's got a real hair up his ass about Morris." "Which Morris? South Dakota Morris or Montana Morris?" "Dakota, of course. What's wrong with you? Did that teacher screw your brains loose?" Enough with the teacher. So what are we going to tell him about Morris?" "I don't know. We better come up with something before Tuesday. But that's not the big thing. The big thing is that goddamn girl." Chapter 2 DeMarco was standing in the basement of his Georgetown home, next to a professional killer. The killer's name was Ralph. It said so, right on his shirt, the name in red thread over the pocket. Yesterday, DeMarco had been doing about the most useless thing a man can do on a Sunday afternoon. He should have been outside mowing his lawn, but instead he was watching a professional golf tournament on television, wondering if Tiger was ever going to get his game back. He had a bowl of popcorn in his lap, a Budweiser clenched in his right hand, when he caught a motion out of the corner of his eye. Something small and gray, and very fast. "Son of a bitch!" he yelled, and the popcorn went flying as he leapt up and he sloshed beer down the front of his pants. He'd seen a mouse. A fucking mouse! He tried to find the critter, but couldn't. It had vanished. He wandered through his house for the next 2 hours, armed with a broom, looking for places where rodents might dwell. He searched in closets and under sinks. He pulled out cardboard boxes filled with crap he should have thrown away years ago. He removed boxes of cereal and pasta from his kitchen cabinets to see if they'd been nibbled on. He found some rice spilled on one of the shelves, but didn't know if that was evidence of mice dining or his own sloppiness. By the time he finished, he'd found nothing, and his home looked like a team of DEA agents had executed a search warrant. Realizing he needed professional help, he called an exterminator with a 24-hour answering service. He told them to send over a cold-blooded killer, but was told that one wouldn't be available until tomorrow morning. That night he couldn't sleep. He kept hearing things, or he imagined he was hearing things, scurrying about behind the walls in his bedroom. He could see in his mind's eye one of the little bastards gnawing on an electrical wire. Ralph showed up at 8 a.m. the next day. He was a swarthy, overweight, balding guy. DeMarco suspected that Ralph's forefathers had disembarked on Ellis Island from a ship originating from Sicily. DeMarco's ancestors could have been on the same ship. "I've never had a rodent problem before," DeMarco said. "Well, it happens," Ralph said. "And it's not about cleanliness, per se." "Per se? What the hell does that mean?" "It means there's rats in every city in America, and just because you live in Georgetown and don't have garbage strewn all over your house doesn't mean you won't get rats." "It wasn't a rat. It was a mouse." DeMarco didn't want to hear the word rat. Mice were cute little things. Some people even had them for pets. Rats were vicious-looking varmints with red eyes bigger than squirrels, and they could bite your nose off while you slept. "All they need," Ralph said, "is a hole big enough to get their head through. If they can get their head through, then they can squeeze their whole body through. I'm talking a hole not even as big as a nickel." Ralph began his search down in the basement, because in his professional opinion, and considering the construction of DeMarco's 70-year-old home, that was the most likely point of entry. DeMarco's basement was unfinished, with concrete floors and walls, and contained his washer, dryer, and furnace. 5 minutes after walking down the steps, Ralph pointed at a couple of small black particles that looked like peppercorns. "There you go," he said. "Rat turds." "It was a mouse," DeMarco said. Ralph focused next on the insulation. The floor joists for the first floor of DeMarco's house sat on the foundation, and bats of fiberglass insulation were crammed between the joists to minimize heat loss. About a minute after Ralph found the mouse turds, he said, "Yep," and tugged on an insulation bat, and hundreds of mouse turds came tumbling out. "Oh, Jesus," DeMarco said. "There's your nest," Ralph said, "or at least one of them." "Oh, Jesus," DeMarco repeated. "I'm going to have to rip out most of this insulation." "But how do they get into the house?" DeMarco asked. Ralph ran his flashlight along the top of the basement walls, and near the electrical panel he stopped and said, "See that?" "What?" "That hole where that one cable is coming through. Looks like it might be an internet cable. You see how much space there is around the cable? Whoever ran it should have filled the hole with caulk. I'm not saying that's the only entry point, but that's one of them." DeMarco's cell phone rang. He was going to ignore it, but then looked at the caller ID. It was Mahoney. "Yeah, hello," he said. "I need to see you," Mahoney said. "Can I wait? I've got a big problem here at the house." But Mahoney had already hung up. "Look, that was my boss, and I have to go," he said to Ralph. "But do whatever you gotta do. Wipe them out. Give me whatever I have to sign, and I'll call you later, and you can tell me what the plan is. But wipe them out." DeMarco passed through security, entered the Capitol, fought his way through a cluster of camera-wielding tourists to reach the stairs, and walked up to the office of the House Minority Leader, John Fitzpatrick Mahoney. Mavis, Mahoney's secretary, was on the phone, chewing somebody out. From what DeMarco could hear, it sounded like some kind of conflict in Mahoney's schedule, and Mavis was blaming the conflict on whomever she was talking to. She finally slammed down the phone and said, "Idiot!" Looking up at DeMarco, she said, "What are you doing here? He's already an hour behind schedule, and it's not even 10, and right now he's supposed to be in two places at once." DeMarco shrugged. "He told me to come see him. I don't know why." "Well, he shouldn't have done that," Mavis snapped. "What can I tell you? He called." "Hey, have you ever had mice in your house?" "What? Of course not. Now you just wait right here," she said, and marched over to Mahoney's office, rapped on the door, and let herself in. She came out 2 minutes later and said, "You can walk with him over to the DNC. She took a breath and said, "I don't know why in the hell he wants to walk. That's going to put him even farther behind." The Democratic National Committee's office was on South Capitol Street, southeast, about half a mile from the Capitol. If Mahoney had a car take him, he would get there in 2 minutes. If he walked, it would take him at least 20 minutes, because Mahoney walked slowly and stopped and bullshitted with everyone he met on the way. DeMarco felt sorry for Mavis. It was impossible to keep Mahoney on schedule, and the main reason why was because Mahoney didn't care about his schedule. At his rank, people would usually wait for him if he was late, and he didn't care how long they had to wait. Mahoney lumbered out of his office a couple of minutes later. He was dressed in a gray suit, a blue shirt, and a red and blue striped tie. On his feet were white Nike running shoes. He did this periodically, made a half-assed effort to lose weight and get some exercise, the effort usually not lasting more than a week. Mahoney was a handsome man with bright blue eyes and snow-white hair. He was 5'11", the same height as DeMarco, but twice as broad across the back and butt. He drank too much, he ate too much, and he smoked cigars. A half-mile walk wasn't going to come anywhere close to offsetting all his vices. He didn't say hello when he saw DeMarco. He just walked toward the door, and DeMarco trailed along behind him. Nor did DeMarco try to speak to him as they were leaving the Capitol, because about every 2 feet somebody would say, "Good morning, Mr. Speaker." If Mahoney didn't know the person, he'd say, "Hey, how's it going? How you doing today?" If he knew the person, he'd stop, shake his or her hand, then chat about whatever popped into his head. Mahoney was no longer the Speaker of the House. He'd lost the job when the Republicans took control a few years ago, but he'd held the job for so long that people still used the title. It was driving him crazy that the Democrats couldn't take back the House, and he spent half his working hours scheming to make that happen, which was probably what he was going to do at the DNC this morning. More scheming. When they finally got outside, DeMarco caught up to Mahoney and walked next to him. "There's a guy out in Montana named Doug Thorpe," Mahoney said. "If it wasn't for him, my name would be on that black wall down there, on the mall. He saved my life twice. He also saved the lives of a dozen other people, too. They gave him a Silver Star. He should have gotten the Medal of Honor." Mahoney never talked about Vietnam. DeMarco had no idea what he did over there or how bad it had been. All DeMarco knew was that Mahoney had just been a kid, barely out of high school, when he enlisted in the Marines. He ended up with shrapnel from a grenade in his right knee, and he limped when it was cold. But that's about all DeMarco knew. Mahoney was as corrupt as any congressman on Capitol Hill. He took money under the table. He did quasi-legal favors for people who helped him stay in office. He used campaign contributions to maintain his lifestyle. He would stab his enemies in the back, and sometimes he'd stab his friends in the back if it were politically expedient to do so. He loved politics more than he loved breathing. He loved the power, the intrigue, and being in the thick of things. But there was one area where Mahoney was above reproach: the proper treatment of veterans. It was the only area where he was above reproach. "Anyway, I want you to go see him," Mahoney said. "In Montana?" DeMarco said. Mahoney ignored the whine in DeMarco's voice. "It's about his granddaughter. According to Doug, she's uncovered some conspiracy out there, and somebody's threatening to kill her." "What kind of conspiracy?" "Hell, I don't know. Something political. I'd had a couple of drinks before he called last night." "Had a couple?" Knowing Mahoney, he'd probably had a lot more than two drinks. Mahoney was an alcoholic. "All I know is that Doug's never asked for a damn thing from me in all the years I've known him. He's a fly fishing guide, and when I was younger, I'd go see him, and we'd go fishing and drink and tell lies about the war. But I haven't seen him in years. Anyway, he said he needed help, and he didn't know who else to go to, and his granddaughter won't listen to reason. So I told him you were going to help him." Before DeMarco could say anything, Mahoney said, "Hang on a minute." He walked over to a street vendor and bought a Danish in a cellophane wrapper. The Danish was loaded with preservatives and had probably been baked a month ago. There was no point in DeMarco asking why he was walking if he was going to eat pastry as he walked. "You don't need to go with me the rest of the way," Mahoney said as he ripped the wrapper off the Danish. "Get Doug's address from Mavis and head on out there today. I told him you'd see him tomorrow morning."
"Tomorrow? But I got—"
"When you find out what's going on, let me know." DeMarco walked back to the Capitol, cursing John Mahoney every step of the way. He didn't want to leave today, not with his house infested with rodents. He could just see coming home from Montana and finding 50 mice in his kitchen, having a feast, dancing like cartoon characters in a Disney movie. He called Ralph.
"Where are you?"
he asked.
"I'm still here at your house, ripping out the insulation. I found another nest."
"Oh, Jesus. Don't leave. I'll be back in less than an hour, and you can tell me what the game plan is."
DeMarco had worked for Mahoney for years. He had an office in the bowels of the Capitol, down in the sub-basement. On the frosted glass door of his office, in flaking gold paint, were the words, "Council Pro Tem for Liaison Affairs." The words were absolutely meaningless. Mahoney had invented them. But DeMarco had an office, he had a title, and the U.S. government paid his salary. He was a GS-13, and had been a GS-13 for almost as long as he'd worked for Mahoney. His chances of getting a raise were between slim and none. DeMarco was Mahoney's fixer, and sometimes his bagman, meaning Mahoney occasionally sent him to collect cash from people who wanted to contribute to Mahoney but didn't want to be known as contributors. More often, if Mahoney had some sticky issue with a constituent or another lawmaker or an old girlfriend, Mahoney had many of those, old girlfriends, DeMarco would be sent to deal with the issue. And usually if DeMarco was sent to resolve a problem, it meant the problem couldn't be handled by Mahoney's legitimate staff in some legitimate fashion. The other thing Mahoney had done many times in the past was loan DeMarco to his friends when his friends had problems, as he was now doing with his buddy Doug Thorpe. DeMarco got Thorpe's address and phone number from Mavis. When he asked if she'd mind booking him a flight and renting him a car, she basically told him to go fuck himself. She did this by simply sniffing. She worked for Mahoney, and only Mahoney. DeMarco descended to his hole-in-the-wall office and used Google to learn that Doug Thorpe lived on the Yellowstone River, about halfway between the towns of Forsyth and Miles City, Montana. He'd never heard of either town, and would have to fly into Billings. The best flight he could get left National at 5:30 p.m. and arrived in Billings 7 hours later, stopping along the way in Salt Lake City. Then it would be a 2-hour drive to Thorpe's place. If DeMarco had had a little voodoo doll of John Mahoney, it would have looked like a pincushion. DeMarco made reservations, flight, hotel, and car, then went home to pack and talk to Ralph. He wanted to know Ralph's agenda for genocide.
"You got two or three choices here," Ralph said. "You got your traps. The good news with traps is the body stays in the trap and you just chuck out the body with the trap. The bad news is the traps aren't all that effective. Rats must have some sort of genetic memory transfer thing where they know the traps will kill them."
Genetic memory transfer? It sounded like the creatures had been created by a mad scientist in a laboratory, some super breed capable of taking over the world.
"Then you got your sonic devices," Ralph said. "They send out this ultrasonic noise that's supposed to drive them out of the house, but most of the time it just drives them insane. And they run back and forth inside the walls bumping into things, but they don't leave. You just end up with deaf, insane rats."
"Great," DeMarco said. "I recommend this stuff," Ralph said, and showed DeMarco a small flat box containing little blue-green pellets.
"What's that?"
"It's called Decon. It's basically a super blood thinner, and it makes them hemorrhage internally and turns their guts to mush. For some reason, they love this shit more than I like clam linguine."
"Yeah, but where do they die? Inside the walls?"
"Well, sometimes. But what's supposed to happen, and what usually happens, is after they eat the stuff, it makes them real thirsty. And they go outside to find water, and they die outside. That's why I'm not going to plug up any entry holes for a week or so."
Now DeMarco had an unwanted image of a mouse bleeding from every orifice, tongue hanging out as it crawled, gasping, toward a pool of water. But what if they don't die outside? What if they rot inside the walls? Well, that's a possibility, but I'd still recommend decon. DeMarco signed a form, like a death warrant for mice, giving Ralph permission to poison the little suckers and absolving Ralph's company of any liability for anything. He also gave Ralph a key and the security code to the house so he could do the work and remove the corpses. For some reason, he trusted Ralph. Then he went to his bedroom and packed for the trip. He normally wore suits when he was working, but this didn't seem like a wear-a-suit trip, visiting some guy who was a fly-fishing guide. He packed one suit, one dress shirt, one tie, and a bunch of casual Montana-like clothes, jeans, sweaters, tennis shoes. Not sure how long he'd be out there, he packed enough underwear for a week. If he was stuck there longer than a week, he'd have to decide if he should wash the underwear or turn his boxers inside out. Chapter 3. The only good thing about flying to Billings, as far as DeMarco was concerned, was that it was the 1st of May. This meant his chances of spending 2 days sleeping in an airport terminal due to weather-related delays were slightly less than normal. The flight, in fact, turned out to be uneventful, meaning his luggage arrived the same time he did, and the planes departed and arrived almost on time. These days, airlines consider almost on time to be outstanding performance. He checked into a Holiday Inn Express about midnight and slept without dreaming of rodents. He awoke at 8, feeling good, gorged himself on pancakes, and took off for Thorpe's place. He found it 2 hours later and thanked the Lord, as he always did, for the guy who'd invented the GPS. Whoever the guy was, he deserved the Nobel Prize and possibly sainthood. Thorpe's home was an honest-to-God log cabin, perched near the banks of the Yellowstone River and surrounded by ponderosa pines. In addition to the cabin, there were 2 sheet metal buildings the size of 2-car garages. One of the buildings was open, and DeMarco could see a snowmobile, a wood splitter, and a large rubber raft on a trailer. Next to the open garage was a shiny black Mercedes that looked out of place in the rural setting. A pile of firewood big enough to last through a cold Montana winter was stacked next to the house, and on the front porch were 2 rocking chairs. Some mixed breed of black and white dog slept between the rocking chairs, and the dog barely raised its head when it saw DeMarco. DeMarco knocked on the front door, and nobody answered. He pulled out his phone and called the number Mavis had given him for Thorpe and heard a phone ringing inside the cabin. Having no better idea, he sat down in one of the rocking chairs, ruffled the dog's head, and looked out at the Yellowstone. Montana, he had to admit, was in a gorgeous part of these United States, and he wouldn't mind spending a week at Doug Thorpe's cabin, sitting on the porch, reading mysteries, and enjoying the sound of the river going by. An hour later, a pickup truck with a crew cab, towing an aluminum boat, pulled into the driveway. 3 men got out of the pickup. The driver saw DeMarco on the porch, gave him a wave, then shook hands with the 2 men who'd been his passengers. DeMarco heard one of the men say, "Thanks again, Doug. We'll see you next year." The 2 guys, both overweight and in their 60s, wore fancy fishing vests with multiple pockets and hats with fishing flies stuck into the crowns. They didn't look like fishermen. They looked like bankers. They got into the Mercedes and took off. The dog got up and walked slowly down to greet the driver. The way it moved, DeMarco figured the mutt was about 100 in dog years. The man gave it a pat on the head and said, "Hey, Daisy." To DeMarco, he said, "Can I help you?" "My name's Joe DeMarco, Mr. Thorpe. John Mahoney sent me." Doug Thorpe was in his 70s, tall, lanky, and tanned. His hair was gunmetal gray, and his eyes were nested in a mass of wrinkles from squinting into the sun. DeMarco was willing to bet the man had better than 20/20 vision. He was wearing a green and red Pendleton shirt, faded blue jeans, and old hiking boots. He looked like the kind of guy who always wore boots. When he shook Thorpe's hand, DeMarco could feel nothing but calluses. "I appreciate John sending you out here," Thorpe said. I hope you can help. How's John doing?
DeMarco wanted to say, he's doing fine considering the fact that he's a devious, self-centered, crooked, conniving, wife-cheating alcoholic. But he didn't say that. Instead, he said,
he's doing fine, sir. He told me he owed you his life.
Well, I don't know about that, Thorpe said. You want a beer? I figured we could sit on the porch and talk about Sarah.
Sure,
DeMarco said. Thorpe opened the front door, which DeMarco noticed wasn't locked, and Daisy followed him inside. He came back a moment later with two cans of Coors. He handed one to DeMarco, popped the top on his beer, and said,
about Sarah. She's my granddaughter. In fact, she's the only family I have left. My wife's been dead for 20 years, and my daughter died 4 years ago. Jenny married a handsome idiot named Johnson, and he liked to fly small planes, you know, Cessnas, Piper Cubs, and such. And he killed them both. So, Sarah's the only one I have left, and I love her to death. Anyway, she's got it into her head that there's some kind of big conspiracy going on.
Conspiracy about what?
You need to talk to her. The story's too complicated for me to follow. But she claims state legislators and judges in Montana and the Dakotas are being bribed. Some of it has to do with natural gas, but to hear her talk, it's about more than gas. Anyway, she's been working on this story, I guess you'd call it a story, for almost 2 years.
Is she a journalist?
No, not really. She doesn't have a job. She dropped out of college her sophomore year because she couldn't figure out what she wanted to do, hooked up with some environmental group, and then started doing her own thing. I guess you'd call her an activist. But the thing about Sarah is she's rich, really rich. My daughter was as smart as a whip, and she bought stock in Microsoft and Apple and Starbucks and any other company you can think of that's hit it big in the last 30 or 40 years. Jenny just knew how to make money. She always managed to buy the stock when it was worth pennies and always sold it before it tanked. And real estate. She'd buy a plot of useless land, and next thing you know, somebody's offering her 10 times what she paid for it. Jenny was just an incredible woman. I don't know why she married that idiot flyboy. Well, Sarah's smart, too. Not as smart as her mom, but smart. But the main thing about Sarah is she's stubborn. And because she's rich, she can afford to be as stubborn as she wants. My daughter was the smartest person I've ever known. Sarah's the most hard-headed person I've ever known.
You told Mahoney that someone was threatening to kill her? DeMarco said.
Yeah. About a year ago, she must have hit a nerve with somebody, and she started getting these harassing phone calls. This guy would call her 2-3 times a day, and usually about 2 or 3 in the morning. He'd say she was telling lies that could cost people their jobs, and if he lost his job, he was going to kill her. The guy called her so much she changed her phone number, but somehow he was able to get her new number.
How did he know she was telling anybody anything?
DeMarco said. She's got one of those blogs on the internet, and she writes about all the stuff she says is going on. I can't imagine many people read it because, well, please don't tell Sarah I said this, but she's a horrible writer. Anyway, she's been harassed with phone calls. They've tried to buy her off, and they've filed lawsuits. Thorpe laughed. These guys must not know how rich Sarah is, because she was actually delighted when they filed the lawsuits. She said, bring them on. She was just looking for the opportunity to have her lawyers depose these guys or make them testify in court. The lawsuits are moving forward, but you know how the courts are. It'll be months or even years before the suits are settled.
Who's they? Who filed the suits? DeMarco asked.
Thorpe waved the question away. Talk to Sarah. She can give you the details, and I don't really care about the lawsuits. If that's all that was going on, I never would have called John. But a week ago, it got serious. She was leaving this diner late at night, and these 3 guys come up to her in the parking lot wearing ski masks. They drag her back behind the diner, knocked her down, touched her in places they shouldn't have, and told her to quit telling all the lies she's been telling. They said the next time they'd take her into the woods, have some fun with her, and leave her there for the animals to eat. They didn't hurt her, but they scared the hell out of her.
Did she call the cops?
Sure, but the cops couldn't find him.
If I ever find him, I'll kill him. He said this in a soft voice, but DeMarco had no doubt the man meant what he'd just said. I'll kill him wasn't hyperbole, not when it came from Doug Thorpe. Thorpe crushed the beer can he was holding like it was made of paper. I just wanted to stop DeMarco. I think she's tilting at windmills and isn't going to accomplish a damn thing. She's been at this for almost 2 years, and as near as I can tell, nobody believes her. At least nobody with any authority, like a state attorney general or a federal prosecutor. But she's not going to stop. I know her. She'll keep pushing until somebody does kill her. What I'm hoping you can do is figure out what's going on and then get John involved. John's got the clout to force somebody with a badge to help her. I'll go see her, Mr. Thorpe. Where does she live? She has a house in Billings. In fact, thanks to her mom, she's got property all over the place. But she's in Bismarck right now. She spends so much time there, she leased an apartment. Oh, DeMarco said. How far is Bismarck from here? Four and a half hours. 4.5 hours? Yeah. If you leave now, you can be there by supper time. I'll send her an email and tell her you're coming. Thorpe shook his head. I'd call her, but she's become so paranoid she thinks her calls are being monitored. And hell, maybe she's right. Chapter 4 Bill and Marjorie met Curtis at a restaurant called the Pierogue Grill near the Radisson where Curtis was staying. The Pierogue Grill was an elegant place, with old red brick walls, dark furnishings, intricate brass chandeliers, and eye-catching artwork on the walls. It had an excellent wine list, and a menu that included venison and buffalo, as well as more traditional fare. But the menu and the elegance were wasted on Curtis, a man who usually had a bowl of soup for dinner. If a restaurant had a children's menu, Curtis would often order from it, not only because the portions were small, but because the kiddie meals cost less. Curtis was a complete mystery to Bill and Marjorie. The man was 74 years old, worth over $1 billion, and if the insurance actuaries were right, he was most likely entering his last decade. A man with that much money and that little time left on Earth ought to be enjoying all the money he'd made. But it seemed as if Curtis had only one interest in life, making more money. He stayed in modestly priced hotels like the Radisson. He didn't drive a luxury car. He didn't own a yacht. He did own a jet, but only because he needed one to get around the country and didn't like to be tied to the airline schedules. His clothes looked like the sort you'd buy at Macy's. Nice enough, but nothing fancy. Bill spent more in his clothes every year than Curtis did. In the time they'd worked for him, as far as they knew, he'd never taken a vacation. He didn't go on cruises. He didn't play golf. He didn't have any hobbies. He spent most of his life on his plane, or in conference rooms and law offices. What in the hell was the point of living that way? When they first met him, Marjorie tried to get him to talk about himself and his family. They knew he was married and had been married to the same poor woman for almost 50 years. He had 2 children. His son was still a bachelor and a doctor in Austin. His daughter was the mother of 2, like Marjorie, and owned an art gallery in Dallas. But even as good as Marjorie was at getting people to talk about themselves, she couldn't draw Curtis out. When he was with them, the only thing he wanted to talk about was whatever problem he was having at the time that was preventing him from making more money. Marjorie eventually stopped asking how his wife, kids, and grandkids were doing. She came to the conclusion that Curtis honestly didn't care how they were doing. Curtis was a small, thin man, about 5'6". His body was almost bird-like, and his head seemed disproportionately large in comparison to his slight frame. The little hair he had left was white and wispy. His eyes were watery and pale blue. He had hearing aids in both ears. He almost always wore suits. But instead of a dress shirt, he usually wore polo shirts or golf shirts under the suit jacket. He'd been born and raised in Texas. His home and headquarters were in Houston. But he didn't have a Texas accent and didn't wear a Stetson or cowboy boots. His shoes were soft, black Dr. Scholl's. His first name was Leonard, and they imagined his wife must call him Leonard or Len or Lenny or something. But the only thing they ever called him was Mr. Curtis.
Most often when they met him, he was alone, but sometimes he was accompanied by a couple of lawyers, and the lawyers always called him Mr. Curtis, too. He was a miserable, miserly, sour old son of a bitch, but he paid Bill and Marjorie so damn much that he could have beaten them with a hickory stick, and they wouldn't have cared. Curtis sipped his coffee, made a face as if it didn't taste right, and got down to business.
So what's happening with Morris?
Walter Morris was a circuit court judge representing the 2nd Judicial District in South Dakota. Circuit court judges in South Dakota ran for election every 8 years, but Morris was planning to retire when his term was up. This meant that Marjorie and Bill couldn't use campaign contributions to sway him. Morris also made a decent salary. He wasn't rich, but he was comfortable and didn't have any debt. Nor did Morris have any vices that they had been able to find, such as cross-dressing or philandering. Marjorie even had Gordy look at his internet history. If Morris had been looking at child pornography, they would have owned the judge for life. But no such luck. The problem with Morris was a pending case having to do with sales tax. One of the many businesses Curtis owned was a company involved in the transportation of refined petroleum products. A pipeline, in other words, that covered 13 states, including South Dakota. It was a complicated case, and the laws governing pipeline taxes were poorly written. But the bottom line was that the company hadn't been charging sales tax for some of its services, and the state treasurer said they should have, meaning the company now owed back taxes. Curtis naturally didn't want to pay the back taxes. Curtis didn't want to pay taxes on anything. And he and two other pipeline companies filed a lawsuit. The next stop for the lawsuit was Judge Morris's bench. Win or lose, the case would go on to the South Dakota Supreme Court, but Curtis wanted a win in Morris's court because he was confident the state Supreme Court wouldn't reverse Morris. "He's been taken care of," Marjorie said.
"How?" Curtis asked.
"The judge," Marjorie said, "has been looking online at condos in Palm Springs." Gordy had discovered this while examining the judge's internet history. Apparently, he and the missus have a hankering to go south in the winter.
"How much will it cost me?" Curtis said.
"52," Marjorie said.
"Shit, is that all?" Curtis said.
It had actually been pretty easy to deal with Morris, a lot easier than Marjorie had expected. She simply sent him an email. In the email, she said she'd heard that he was looking for a California condo. She included a link showing a condo that was much nicer than the ones he'd been looking at on the internet, and said the owner might be willing to sell for 15% less than the listed price. Curtis would pay the 15%, which was about $52,000 on a $350,000 condo, but she didn't say that in the email. Marjorie said that if Morris was interested, she'd be happy to meet him for a drink and fill him in on the details. When Marjorie met with Morris, she went straight at him. The fact that he'd shown up for the meeting was enough for her to know that she didn't have to pussyfoot around with the guy. She told him that she was hoping for a favorable outcome on the pipeline sales tax case, as the man she represented, who she never named, thought that being required to pay back taxes because of a confusing law was not only unfair, but in order to scrape up the money to pay the state, her employer might have to let a few people go.
"Are you trying to bribe me?" the judge said, trying to act all stern and righteous and shocked.
But he couldn't have been that shocked. He had to know before he met with Marjorie that she was going to want something in return for the great price on the condo.
"Of course not, Your Honor," Marjorie had said. "No one is offering you any money. I'm just telling you that you can get a good deal on a Palm Springs condo, a deal you could probably get for yourself if you negotiated hard enough."
"And if I don't rule the way you want?" the judge said.
"The real estate market in California is pretty volatile, Your Honor. You can never tell what will happen. Why don't we wait until after you rule on the case, and if you're still interested, give me a call. I can promise you that the buyer won't sell until after your ruling." The judge didn't say yes or no. He just sat there scowling, as if he smelled something foul in the room, then said he was late for a meeting and left the bar. A bar he'd picked, that was about as far from his normal watering hole as it could get. But Marjorie knew what was going to happen next. She had no doubt. Morris would find a way to convince himself that the right thing to do was rule against the tax-grabbing state of South Dakota. 90% of the time, Bill and Marjorie behave the same as most people representing a special interest group or a particular business. They paid attention to legislation that could cost Curtis money or make him money. They supported, through legitimate campaign contributions, politicians likely to favor Curtis. They pooled their resources with like-minded folks to pay for television ads to pass or defeat various bills and get the right people elected. They hired lawyers to throw monkey wrenches into the machinery when a monkey wrench was needed. In other words, just politics as usual. But every once in a while, a little extra effort was needed to solve a problem, as was the case with Judge Morris. And this was why Curtis paid them so well. You can't teach people to do what Marjorie and Bill did. They had a God-given instinct, guided by experience, to know who was corruptible and who wasn't. And then the ability to persuade those people to take a bribe in such a manner that the person wouldn't feel that he or she had really been bribed at all. Like with Morris. Morris could legitimately rule either way with regard to the sales tax issue. He just needed to come up with a basis for his ruling that would morally satisfy himself that his decision had nothing to do with the condo, but was instead in accordance with the Constitution of the great state of South Dakota. In his own mind, Morris wouldn't even connect his good fortune to the ruling he made. He was a righteous and honorable man, and just lucky when it came to real estate.
"Now, what about the goddamn kid?" Curtis said. "I've had enough of that little bitch."
Chapter 5. 2 hours after leaving Doug Thorpe's cabin, driving eastward on I-94, DeMarco crossed the Montana-North Dakota border and stopped at a scenic vista near Medora, North Dakota, population 112. A sign informed him that he was looking out at the Badlands of the Theodore Roosevelt National Park. He'd always thought that Badlands was just a name for the places where outlaws like Butch Cassidy and Sundance went to hide, but learned that it was a geological term for rocky terrain extensively eroded by wind and water. The sign also said he might see, although he didn't, bison, feral horses, elk, and prairie dogs. He wanted to see a prairie dog, having never seen one before. An hour or so later, he stopped again to get the kinks out of his back and to be treated to the sight of Salem Sioux, the world's largest black-and-white Holstein cow. It was made of fiberglass, stood 38 feet high, and was 50 feet long. Not a sight he would have seen had he not traveled 1,500 miles from Washington, D.C. He crossed the Missouri River and drove into Bismarck, almost 5 hours after leaving Thorpe's place. The white, 19-story state capitol building, the tallest structure in the city, dominated the view. He checked into another Holiday Inn Express, and his room seemed identical to the one he'd had in Billings. Even the abstract art over the bed was the same. He called the number Thorpe had given him for Sarah Johnson, and she answered on the second ring.
"Hi, this is Joe DeMarco. Would you like to get together to talk?"
"Yeah, you bet. There's a Starbucks."
"How about picking a place that serves a decent martini? It's been a long day. I need alcohol, not caffeine."
"Oh, well, let's see."
After a long pause, she said,
"We could go to Minerva's, I guess. It's near the Capitol. I don't drink much, but I've heard it's okay."
"I'll find it," DeMarco said. "I'll see you in an hour."
DeMarco figured in a city the size of Bismarck, he could get anywhere in an hour.
"How will I recognize you?"
With a name like Minerva's, DeMarco had been expecting a traditional tavern, neon Budweiser signs in the windows, photos of the softball team Minerva's sponsored behind the bar. Or even better, maybe Minerva was the name of a famous madam back when they were building the railroads across the Great Plains, and the bar would be located in a historical brothel with embossed red wallpaper and portraits of plump naked ladies on the walls. It turned out, however, that Minerva's was in a low brick building with a green roof, and was a family-friendly restaurant with a well-lit bar, tables set with white cloth napkins, large comfortable booths, and a wholesome girl-next-door type bartender. DeMarco ordered a martini, and about 5 minutes after his drink arrived, Sarah Johnson walked through the door dressed as she'd told him she would be. Blue jeans, a white turtleneck, and a woolly green vest. When he saw her eyes scanning the patrons looking for him, he raised a hand. Sarah was 6 feet tall, and according to her grandfather, 22 years old. She had alabaster white skin, blue eyes, a flawless complexion, and butterscotch blonde hair reaching halfway to her shoulders. She wasn't beautiful, but she was striking because she was young and tall and had a nice figure and just glowed with good health. She took a seat across from DeMarco and started off by saying, "Grandpa's email said you work for John Mahoney and might be able to help me, but he didn't tell me exactly what you do." "You want a drink?" DeMarco asked. "Not really. I've got a lot to do tonight, and would just as soon get to the point."
"Okay. Well, as for what I do, I don't actually work for Mahoney. I mean, I'm not on his staff."
"Oh," she said, looking disappointed.
"I'm a guy Mahoney calls from time to time when he's got a problem, or when one of his friends is having one, like your grandfather. He sent me out here to see if I can help."
"Does Mahoney listen to you?"
DeMarco shrugged. "As much as he listens to anyone. Mahoney's a politician, and like most politicians, he acts primarily out of his own self-interest. But he's loyal to his friends, and he told me your granddad saved his life in Vietnam. So he'll probably help you if he can and if he doesn't have to stick his neck out. But that's the best I can tell you."
He could see Sarah wasn't enamored with his answer, but said, "Well, since nobody else is willing to do anything, I guess talking to you can't hurt. Tell me what you're doing that's making people want to kill you. All your grandfather said is that you think there's some kind of big conspiracy going on."
"I don't think. I know. I just can't prove it. And I can't get anybody in law enforcement or the big-time media to listen to me."
"I'm listening," DeMarco said.
"You know anything about state government in Montana or the Dakotas?"
"No."
"Yeah, well, the chances are, if you lived in one of those states, you still wouldn't know anything. People pay attention to national politics because that's mostly what's on the news. They know if the president's thinking about bombing Iran or screwing with Social Security, but they don't have a clue what's happening in their own state legislatures. To find out what's going on in a state legislature, you have to really want to know. You have to watch some little local channel that nobody watches and that's drier than dirt. You have to read bills that are written in some language other than English. So nobody pays a lot of attention to what's going on in Helena, Pierre, or Bismarck. But that's where the action really is. If a state can pass a law that's not covered by federal law, they can make anything happen. Hell, the states can even pass laws that go against federal law, and sometimes the federal government can't do anything to stop them. To use a simple example, it's like in Washington and Colorado where they passed laws legalizing pot, even though the feds say pot's illegal." Sarah Johnson's intensity was palpable. After 2 minutes with her, DeMarco could tell that she was completely committed to whatever she was doing. He could sense her seriousness, her resolve. No, maybe resolve wasn't the right word. Maybe obsession was more accurate. Whatever the case, he could see the passion blazing in her eyes, and he thought, Joan of Arc. That's who this young woman was. She was so zealous about what she believed in that she was willing to be burned at the stake. She wasn't an activist. She was a crusader and a would-be martyr. "The other thing you need to understand," Sarah said, "is that the people elected to state legislatures are paid hardly anything. They barely make minimum wage. In South Dakota, a legislator is paid $12,000 a year and gets $110 a day in per diem when the legislature is in session. If you do the math, that's less than 18 grand if you don't take special sessions into account, and it's about the same in Montana and North Dakota. What this means is that these legislators, unless they're rich or retired with pensions, all have other jobs. They're ranchers and farmers and salesmen and teachers. Hell, half of them take the job because they need the lousy salary it pays. The other thing is, a lot of times, they'll run unopposed, because who else wants a job that pays so little? So what I'm trying to tell you is, if you want to control what happens in a state, you don't waste your money bribing Montana's only congressman in the U.S. House of Representatives. What you do is introduce a bill in the Montana State House that does what you want, and if you need the votes, you pay off these part-time politicians who need